Welcome to Created Terrain, a podcast of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. I'm Cal Beissner, the president of the Cornwall Alliance, and our task as a ministry is to educate the public and policymakers on biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the gospel of Jesus Christ, together with the worldview, the theology, the ethics that come with Christ and from Him in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. And my topic today is going to be a little unusual for this program. Frankly, I don't have it planned out. But I have a good friend here, Dan Jansen, who's been an agricultural missionary in South Sudan and other parts of Africa for a good number of years. He has a long history as a farmer himself. And he's been visiting me, and we've just had so much fun talking that it occurred to me, we ought to share this. And so, without any plan at all, we're just going to have a conversation here and invite you to be in on this conversation. Dan, thanks very much for speaking with me. Just yes. Introduce yourself. You've got an elevator speech here to tell people who you are and a little quick bit about your background.
Sure. Yes. I actually have a background. I grew up on a family farm, very diversified. And when I was a young person, I really got involved in studying all kinds of things related to gardening and agriculture. And we had missionaries that come to our house, and they, since I had an interest in agriculture and gardening in particular, the missionary recognized an opportunity for me for the future. He said, you could do agricultural missions. And from that point on in my life, I realized that God was calling me toward agricultural development or agricultural missions. And so I went on through high school to college and got a degree in international agricultural development, extension education, and crop and soil science from Oregon State University. And then continued to proceed in that direction, spent some time in Kenya, Africa, working with that same missionary, and before he retired, and did my extension internship there. And then more recently, as my kids have empty nested, I got involved with hospital in South Sudan that was needing some community development help, and started making trips over there. My wife and I actually moved to South Sudan in 2016, and we were there 8 years, and we've just returned back to the States because of some health issues, declining health of a mother-in-law, and who needs more care. And so now I'm focusing on ministry here in the States, and some of the things, even looking at the opportunities to help out in the extreme environmental radical extremism in the environment and its effect on not only developed countries but underdeveloped countries as well.
Mm-hmm. Dan has been particularly helpful to me. As I look at various things that are being promoted as great ideas in agriculture, in earth stewardship regarding how we treat the soil of our farms and so on, and it has seemed to me, Dan, that even a lot of what Christians are saying about this seems to be rooted in the very best of intentions. You know, they really care about mm-hmm. God's earth. They mm-hmm. want to take good care of the soil and so on. And yet often, maybe not really the best scientific understanding of how we really are stewards of the soil. So, for example, just earlier, mm-hmm. 20 minutes ago, you and I were talking about the sabbatical year laws under the Old Testament in Exodus 11 and Leviticus 25, where God instructed the Israelites that every seventh year they were not to plant, they were not to cultivate the soil, they were not to do systematic reaping, they were just to eat what grew of its own accord. And he had also promised them that, in fact, in that seventh year, he would see to it that enough grew that it would last them for 2 years, because they wouldn't be planting then, and they'd need something to go through not just that year, but the next year between planting and harvesting. And many Christians who are concerned about soil stewardship will argue from that somehow we really need to not plant soil every year. Now, I recognize that crop rotation is a good idea, that letting land lie fallow for a while is a good idea, that these things help to preserve soil fertility. But you and I were talking about this morning, I had read in my own devotional reading John Calvin's commentary on those portions of Scripture. And he had pointed out that since God had actually promised the Israelites that in that sixth year, the land would really bear double so that they would have food not just for that year, I'm sorry, in that seventh year, not the sixth year, they'd have food not just for that year, but for the following year also, because they wouldn't really have a new harvest until the end of that following year. John Calvin argues that the reason God gave this commandment was not to protect the fertility of the soil, though in fact fallowing does protect the fertility of the soil, but rather to drive home the importance of honoring the weekly Sabbath and that seventh year sabbatical year, and ultimately the 50th year Jubilee year, as a matter of rest, which shows our trust in God. So I shared that with you, Dan, and you had some interesting comments about the implications of that for our stewardship of soil and whether what those passages really require is, you know, the fallowing and the crop rotation or something like that, or rather they're pointing us to rest and trust in God. And if there are other ways that we can also ensure the continued fertility of the soil, fallowing and rotation are not necessarily the best thing. Can you just enlarge on that for me? I kind of went on there a little bit, but
sure, no problem.
Yeah.
It was the first time that I actually started thinking about this, that the sixth year could be a miraculous year, because it's contrary to logical thinking that as you farm something for 6 years, the sixth year would be the year you'd expect to have maybe even the least year as you're consecutively farming, because they had this seventh year fallow. So to have that year be double is quite a testimony to a miraculous expectation from God. And if he came through, this was like a regular pointing back to God as a miraculous God. God is the sustainer. God is the provider. And so in the power of God. And so that might have been a bigger issue, bigger aspect of what was happening with the Jubilee. And then also, I think there was some harvest of volunteer type things. The fruit would still produce, and the vines would still produce, and then there would be some volunteer things that would also be food for the poor and gleaning opportunities, and then the animals would get a rest, and the labor would get a rest and be able to enjoy the environment. Yeah. If you think about enjoyment, I grew up on a farm, and we had real difficult time going on vacations because the warm part of the year, that was where we were out working.
Yeah.
And so we rarely ever got that time when it was a nice time of year to ever go out and enjoy the environment. But God was providing that opportunity for them. And I think that's really incredible. And getting to the other side of this is, are there techniques? Yes. And I'm really expecting that in the future, as we look at intercropping, which is something that was prohibited back then because it showed
that's sowing several different seeds in the same field.
Exactly. Right? Okay. That was prohibited back then because it gave showed allegiance to this concept of mixing things would actually bring the favor of the gods. And so we are not, I don't believe we're restrained by that today in terms of
And that
of
was
the,
partly too to reinforce the distinction between the Israelites, the Jewish, mm-hmm.
yes.
Jewish people,
mm-hmm.
and the Gentiles around them.
Exactly.
So you
exactly.
were not to follow the ways of the Gentiles, mm-hmm. and the Gentiles mm-hmm. intercropped not so much from agricultural science understanding, but from this was what they thought pleased their gods. Isn't mm-hmm. that it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And you can get this. I've read quite a number of papers on intercropping, and you can get maybe a 15-20% or more increase in actual productivity because there's differential uses of resources, and there is
the different plants use different nutrients from the soil,
nutrients and spatial
nutrients back in.
Spatial orientation okay. in terms of receiving light, all those things. There's a loss when you don't plant between something that's planted further apart for a particular part of the season, and there are crops that'll utilize that, and there's crops particularly legumes that will fertilize that soil in between, and so you get the fallow restoration sometimes coming from the intercropping side of things. So there's a real benefit to that, and a benefit from crop rotation, breaking the cycles of diseases and pests, particularly nematodes in the soil, because nematodes build up and they're focused and they're more specific to each particular crop.
Pardon my ignorance, but what are nematodes?
Nematodes are little tiny little worm type things that are that are almost microscopic that burrow in, and they will extract nutrients. And okay. so there's
So the more of those there are, the more they extract some of those nutrients, right?
Yeah.
But there's also some benefit.
There's some beneficial nematodes as well.
Aerating the soil.
But the dagger nematodes, those are somehow since the fall, they have gotten into, it's kind of like mosquitoes, they've kind of gotten into the wrong type. They're not going the direction what God's original intent for them.
Okay.
For them.
When we were talking about this earlier, there were two directions that we went with it that I'd like us to go again here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One was, we talked about how the requirement of this seventh year, let the land lie fallow and don't plant, don't reap, just eat what grows of its own accord, taught you trust in God
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and not to fear natural forces, so to speak. And the other thing that we talked about was how the worldview behind this sabbatical year regulation was one that really recognized that God's in control.
Right.
That the world doesn't just kind of run on of its own accord. God is active. Mm-hmm. God is active in how crops work and everything else. And the Enlightenment mentality that says, look, matter and energy is all there is, and mm-hmm. it's just, you know, everything goes on by the laws of nature. And if God created everything, he hasn't had anything to do with it since then. Build on that. As a farmer and a missionary about agricultural creation stewardship, try to build, if you will, on both of those things, namely our need for the fear of God rather than fear of nature, and our need for going back to a biblical worldview instead of the Enlightenment worldview.
Right. Well, in the Enlightenment, or even the Greeks, Stoics, were focused on natural law, and that there wasn't anything really miraculous. God did not interact with us in a miraculous way, and that was what was emphasized. And so, I think that looking at this and reexamining the fact that it's the sixth year, and God is producing a, even it says a triple yield in Leviticus 25, it's around verse 21. Yeah. Yes. So it's a testimony that we're not subject to the whims of natural forces. We are have a miraculous God who's intervening on our behalf, and
does that mean that we can just ignore the typical way that chemistry and physics and all that happen? Can we just ignore those because, after all, God's in control?
No, a miracle is something that is a divine interaction. So God put in place the natural order of things that we can depend on that, because that was one of the things that made a distinction between Christianity was able to use science and the established order of things rather than the whim of the gods, which is what kept the ancient people in constant fear that they would invoke some kind of fear of the some kind of repercussion or anger or ire of the gods or the ancestors. Yep. And so they lived in constant fear of the environment. We don't today for that reason, but we also have lost this idea of a miraculous God that's willing to uphold and interact with us, moves through time with us, and mm-hmm. interacts with us on a personal level, a relational level, yeah. on a daily basis, and is willing to do miraculous on our behalf.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about Jeremiah chapter 5, mm-hmm. Beginning around verse 19 or 20, mm-hmm. where God says to the people of Judah, this is in the midst of his warning them that that the exile is coming, mm-hmm. And he says to them, you know, basically, you don't fear me. And because you don't fear me, you do all sorts of things that I forbid you to do, mm-hmm. and you live the way the surrounding Gentiles live. And because you don't fear me, you're afraid that the springtime rains won't come and the harvest time rains won't come and you won't have a good harvest. But if you feared me, I would see to it that you would have those things. So because you don't fear me, you fear other things. If you feared me, you wouldn't need to fear other things. In your experience in South Sudan and Kenya and other parts of Africa with subsistence farmers, did you see anything that would relate to that? I know this is a surprise question, but how did the fear of God or the lack thereof affect the way people handled farming in Africa?
Well, here's the way I approached it, and it may not be a direct answer, but I noticed that people who had a relationship with God and desired to fulfill the Great Commission, which is basically the maximal way to bless other people with truth. Truth is transformative. Truth brings life. Life in lies in a culture bring oppression. So if we're applying lies, and we might be it's going to reflect in even laziness in the way we manage things, or just barely getting by and not saving up for a bad year, and maximizing our potential and not reaching out to the poor and the needy. That was also in Jeremiah chapter 5. And so as we experience the joy of finding fulfillment in reaching out to the poor and the needy and to maximizing our potential, finding time for ministry, that will cause us to find more efficient ways of doing things, take an interest in science, take an interest in these things, because that's what the reformers did and the revival periods. There was a more interest in solving these types of problems because of Christian compassion. And so we want to make sure that that's there.
Yeah, it was not unusual back in the 18th and 19th centuries for pastors to be deeply involved in scientific investigation.
Mm-hmm.
You had a lot of them who were at the forefront of scientific discovery, especially, I think, in agriculture, but in other fields as well. And I think that's because they saw it as part of their calling and the calling of every Christian to learn how to use God's world in a way that goes from that takes it from subsistence to abundance. You know, and right now, I wish you all were here and could see Dan. He's wearing a polo shirt, that has written on it, "Subsistence, no, beyond sustainability to maximal blessing." And I think you told me once you designed this shirt and, and had it made. Tell us what's behind that.
Well, when I'm in Africa and people come from the West and local people feel that their situation is so oppressive, so difficult that the best they can do is subsistence. And when us Westerners go over there and try to say the best we can do is people eat, and I say no, let's move people beyond that. Let's even say that we need sustained expansion or expandability, excuse me for making up a new word, but I'm willing to push back against the Club of Rome report that says that we're going to run out of all these resources and everything's going to be scarce and the future looks very dim because overpopulation and like bacteria in a petri dish, we're all going to run out of resources. I'm pushing back against that concept, even the sustainability concept. Let's put our goals high because God gave us an abundance. God is a benevolent God. God is a God that's provided resources everywhere in the world, and it's to steward those resources to maximally bless others. And having the foundation of maximally blessing and serving other people instead of a rights-based system or a selfish system or a system that says that there's no future beyond the grave. That kind of system produces selfishness and selfish ambition and political power that extorts that power to oppress other people and produces hedonism, all those things. But when we get back to the Great Commission, we have the right foundation. We're willing to focus and put our lives aside and our some of our desires or our lusts aside to actually maximally blessed. I'm thinking of George Washington Carver, and I'm thinking also of and what he dedicated himself, that kind of passion toward using our gifts and abilities and talents and desires that are moving toward a right way to use them rather than for our own selfish wants.
But what it sounds like to me is that you are pulling together the Great Commission with the dominion mandate of Genesis 1:28,
exactly,
because you're at least what I'm getting from what you're saying is in part this, that as we seek to make disciples of all nations, teaching them to obey all things that God has commanded us, well, the very first command that God gave to Adam and Eve together to Adam and Eve together, right? Genesis 1:28.
Yes.
The first command was Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and everything that moves on the face of the earth.
Yes.
And we, Adam and Eve, our great, 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 great grandparents, right? Standing in for us, representing us, failed at that. When we thought to ourselves, oh, we don't have to trust God. We don't have to believe God. In fact, if we disbelieve God, then we get to be like God by defining good and evil for ourselves. And so they ran away from that command to subdue and rule the earth. And now, if we want humanity to fulfill the dominion mandate, we want it to be done by human beings who are not in rebellion against God, who therefore, in other words, have been reconciled to God by Christ, and that's how the gospel and the dominion mandate go together. So that seems to me to be at the heart of what you're doing, Dan. You're not going either or on this, right?
Right. Every single one of my emails that goes out has a subscript or a taglines that talk about the need to be fruitful and multiply and create human resources to send into all the world to bring blessing. And at the same time, we're to push back against any strongly push back. Subdue is a strong word. Mm-hmm. And it's not about oppressing people, but it's pushing back against anything that undermines human flourishing. And it's maximizing value addition opportunities from stewarding all the opportunities, stewarding all the resources that God has given us to maximize blessing for the whole world.
Yeah, and what we are to subdue and have dominion over is not other people. It's the earth.
And the toil.
And the things that that grow on the earth, live on the earth, but it's not other people. Augustine pointed out, you know, God gives us dominion over natural things, not over other men. And it's when we, it's when we seek to rule other people's lives that we begin, in essence, trying to usurp God's role.
Yes.
And this is why freedom is so important. And of course, we don't mean licentiousness. We mean the freedom to live in obedience to God, to his callings. Freedom is so important to human well-being and to human development. And so that's also, I know, that's another part of your message as you have taught in schools in Africa, as you've taught farmers there. How does that confront typical thinking in Africa?
Well,
or here in America?
Sure,
frankly.
Well, one of the basics of what I teach in the worldview, because I match worldview with agricultural development concepts, and so what I'm teaching is that God made everything, and God is owner of everything, and so we are stewards of God's creation. That means we don't own it like we're supposed to keep other people from, like restricting other people from utilizing, but it's more in the nature of how do we steward to maximize the blessing to others. So recognizing God as the owner, that's really a key fundamental principle. And then utilizing the Great Commission and utilizing 2 Timothy 2:2, which says we're to teach others who will in turn teach others, and the multiplication principle, that is what God intended when he sent us out with the Great Commission. Right. And so we're to have that kind of Christian worldview influence through evangelism and discipleship to transform the world. And part of the benefit of that is we see toil has reduced, and the environment, the strains of the environment has reduced and reduced. Now we have 98% less deaths as a result of the environment than we had 100 years ago. And we do things in a much simpler way without toil. And we don't have to have slaves to do things like they did in previous generations. Everything that the slave did, now the machines are doing.
Yeah. Now you said, you know, God owns everything. Some people will argue from, okay, God owns everything to, therefore we don't own anything and private property is a problem. And everything needs to be just divided equally among all. How do you respond to that kind of an argument?
Well, there's two aspects to that I would respond to. One is the tragedy of the commons. Everywhere I go, and even if you take Scottsdale, Arizona, as a prime example, you see three or four parts of the city, and three of the quadrants of the city are actually under private ownership. There's a quarter of the city that's under Native American, commonly owned. That area is not developed at all, and you can see it right on the map. And there's only like a football stadium there, and that's about it. That's the only thing there. And in the same type of thing you see overseas, where they've tried to plant the Great Green Wall in Africa. Well, the people decided that, oh, their grazing animals would enjoy these trees that were planted. And so without private ownership, I think we see little of the progress that could be made, because owner takes care of his land. And when it's all in common, it's tragedy of the common. And then also there's the side of it that there's a disincentive to produce. If you can go and vote in laws that demand that wealth be transferred from someone else to yourself, and you're envious because they've got more than you. This is returning back to the same type of problems that we see in the developing part of the world, what's called the demand shame or limited good, where a relative who produces more for some reason or earns more money, you can go to them and demand, hey, you don't need that. You need to give it to us. So what we do about that is we bring in methods of savings groups to where this whole group gets to decide how this will happen. So God has given us some really good tools to move things in the right direction, but we don't, in my opinion, we don't really want a system where there's tragedy of the commons or where there's the tragic effect of making demands on other people and expropriating what their productivity for ourselves.
So God's ownership of everything doesn't negate human ownership of some things, right? Instead, our ownership is a subordinate one, but it's still real. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you can have, as the eighth commandment, you shall not steal.
That's right.
If God just owned everything and nobody had any property rights in anything, there wouldn't be any sense to that commandment. Dan, I'd like you to talk a little bit more about, one of the things that you've talked with me a bit about in the past is the assumption on the part of many people that, say, organic farming, and you might even address the question of what that means, organic farming is somehow or other morally better or technically better than farming using artificial chemicals, whether fertilizers or insecticides, pesticides, herbicides. Would you address that for us a little bit? Because I think there's a lot of confusion about that.
Sure. The way that I look at this, based on the research I've done and having grown up on a farm where we utilized various pesticides and fertilizers, which are a no-no according to the organic, I decided to try to research this a little bit and look at what would be a godly perspective, because a godly perspective would be focused on maximizing the blessing and being able to look at all the different potential tools that we use to manage a farm and analyze the safety factor of those different tools. And so as I look at safety in particular, I'm looking at the fact that in organic production, they do an interesting thing. They say, okay, yes, we cannot use arsenic because arsenic is harmful. It's organic. We can't use rotenone because rotenone is considered to have a harmful residue. We can't use tobacco. Now, tobacco are derived products. And so as you start getting down the list, then you go, well, it looks kind of like we ought to do this with everything. We ought to look at the safety of organic products and compare them to the safety of various synthetic products. And if you look at something like an insect growth regulator is one of your safest products because it's tackling it's a chitin inhibitor so that it doesn't form an exoskeleton. And it doesn't have a toxic effect to humans, not at all. And so, but yet, if you're an organic producer, you can't use that one because that was a synthesized hormone that restricts the and inhibits the chitin production or formation, so it can't.
Pardon my interruption, but it just occurred to me that sort of thinking seems to me to kind of go against Genesis 1:28, where we're supposed to subdue and rule what we find in the earth and all the various things that live on it or over it or in the waters, right? That assumption that somehow because something is synthetic, we shouldn't use it seems to me to be saying, okay, so there's a part of the earth that we're not supposed to subdue and rule. But we are going to take this arsenic, which is natural, and we're going to use that despite the fact that there are greater risks to us.
Well, it's restricted, so it becomes a arbitrary, it becomes more arbitrary, or even a bias, or it's not really following the rules of what's safety and what's not safety, and so that's why I kind of throw out this strict organic type movement and say, let's look at all of these tools that we can use in agriculture, not throw the baby out with the bathwater, and start looking at their relative safety. And then I also think about this. There's a research been done by a guy named Dr. Ames. He was
Bruce
the one.
Ames.
Bruce yeah, Ames. Bruce yeah. Ames, yes. And he developed the system for testing mutagenicity of various compounds. And I think it was 52 different naturally occurring chemicals that are naturally derived from plants. He extracted them from plants, and he found that half of them had propensity to cause cancer. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's like the same proportion for years and years he'd been testing industrial and pesticides for that same type of propensity, and found that about half of them on average, this is just on average, yeah, would potentially lead to cancer at the levels that they were tested at.
Artificiality was no necessary multiplier of carcinogenicity. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
And so he cautions people to just have this bias against anything synthetic because that doesn't make sense. It's not logical. It's biased to have a viewpoint that's against using synthetic products.
And if I remember correctly, Ames actually pointed out that some of the substances that plants produce in themselves as natural insecticides
defend themselves against herbivores.
Insecticides and rodenticides. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Some of those substances that plants naturally produce, they produce more of when they are under attack because they're not protected by the synthetic chemicals. And then because of that, they are more carcinogenic than they otherwise would be, including when exposed to the synthetic protective chemicals. Is that right?
Well, your liver, God gave us a liver that kind of processes those kinds of things out and puts it into the urinary urinary expulsion. And so we're very blessed to have an organ that sorts these things out and gets rid of things. But when it comes to plants, they can actually chemically smell when some kind of an insect or an herbivore is, or a rodent or whatever is eating on the plant. If they're downwind, they sense it and they pick up the chemical signature and they start to produce up to 10,000 times the normal level of that particular chemical in the plant. So a good example is antelopes in a particular game park. They were trying to figure out why these, like 1,000 of them, had died. And it's because the herbivores had normally they could eat a little bit of tree leaf, but in this case there was a drought and they were eating a lot more, so that chemical signature was everywhere. Huh. and the amount of tannins that the antelope were eating were a death to them.
Beyond their capacity to
process out. And so it was killing them. Huh. And so this type of thing happens, and it was just, you know, basically downwind chemical signature.
Dan, this has been a lot of fun. Our podcast normally goes about 10 to 15 minutes. We've gone over 40 minutes already here and may have to edit some out, I think. But it's been great having you on the program with us. And I hope to do something similar in the future. For all of you out there who have been following the Cornwall Alliance, I want you to know that Dan Dranzen is one person who is actually volunteering some of his time to help us with some research, some writing, and speaking here and there. And it's just a delight to have him visiting me here today. He actually lives 1,000 or so miles away from me, but it's great to be together. Thank you again for listening to Created to Reign. Remember that the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation is a nonprofit organization, 501c3, supported entirely by donations from private individuals like yourself. If you'd like to help out our work here, just go to cornwallalliance.org/donate, and you can donate online. So thank you again for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. That really helps through the algorithms to get more people to know about us. And tell your friends about us. Till next time, God bless, and trust in Him so that you need not fear anything else.